I call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee meeting to order. A quorum is present. And our first order of business will be to approve the minutes from both the joint HHS Reform and Finance Committee and the separate HHS Reform Committee on February 17th. Would someone move to approve the minutes? So we have Representative Baker has moved to approve the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Members, seeing that we have five bills on the agenda today, we will give each bill a maximum time of 20 minutes. And our first up is Representative Anderson's House File 352, which is establishing the Healthy Eating Here at Home program. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief to be respectful of your time. But essentially what this bill does is it allows for individuals that are eligible for SNAP benefits to take that eligibility and use it at our farmer markets. This does two things. One, hopefully it inspires them to do more healthy eating, but then also it supports our locally grown produce here in the state of Minnesota. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody involved. It helps get people on the right path for health overall. And I would just ask for your support. I do have some people here that are interested in testifying. I have asked that they be brief because I know you guys have a big schedule. So if you would indulge them a little bit.
Absolutely, Representative Anderson. I want to introduce your guest and say your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid and here to support Representative Anderson's bill, and thank you very much. You have a packet in front of you, and I'll just tell you quickly what's in that packet. The first page shows who is endorsing this bill from the Bipartisan Legislative Childhood Obesity Task Force, Minnesota Healthy Kids Coalition, and some other anti-hunger partners across the state. We also have some words of support from markets. This is really just a start of support from the markets. We've had a lot of support coming in, and we tried to capture some of those words of support. The next page shows where the authorized markets are that accept SNAP, so you can see that it has a statewide presence. And the last page is it says Market Bucks 2013. So this bill is really based on a pilot that Blue Cross Blue Shield ran for a few years to see if this really works. Does this work to give SNAP participants these vouchers to buy more healthy foods for their family? And it was a hugely successful pilot. They did evaluate it and see that people's consumption of healthy produce really did increase and that the voucher made a big difference in consumer habits. So if you want more information about that pilot that this is based on, that sheet is there. And then just the final sheet, it's a color sheet that you'll see has Paul Bunyan and Babe Blue Ox in the middle. And this is just how this program works. So the allocation of market bucks or vouchers to help SNAP participants buy these healthy foods are distributed statewide to the authorized markets. A shopper or consumer, a SNAP person, will go to a central, kind of a central booth in the market and swipe their SNAP EBT card. And what happens is the person at that, the booth operator at that central place generally gives them wooden tokens for their SNAP dollars that they can use at the individual stalls. And then what this bill would do would allow for that incentive. It's on the sheet, it's called Market Bucks. That's what the Blue Cross Blue Shield pilot was. But you would get this $1 coupon up to $10. And then you could take your wooden tokens and your paper coupons, your Market Bucks, and take them to a vendor and buy healthy produce with it. So that's kind of how the program works. And if you have further questions, I can stand for those. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. State your name for the records, please.
My name is Steve Krikaba. I live in Edina, Minnesota. I'm here representing Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger. I do serve on Mazon's National Board of Directors. It's a national anti-hunger advocacy group. We work to ensure that hungry people have access to nutritious food today and to develop long-term solutions so that no one goes hungry tomorrow. I'm also the co-chair of Mazon's advocacy project in Minnesota. Mazon does not organize state chapters per se, but we do when we are taking action on a state or local issue. We organize groups of volunteers to take the lead. And so I and my co-chair are working with the other partner synagogues in Minnesota and with other anti-hunger organizations to support state programs that reduce hunger. We are supportive and very enthusiastic about the prospect for HF 352 to establish a healthy eating here at home program in our state. I want to thank Representative Sarah Anderson and committee members Representative Freiberg and Representative Pearson and the other House co-sponsors for their leadership on this bill. We appreciate that the bill has bipartisan support and is supported by rural and urban legislators. The program will achieve three important benefits for low-income Minnesotans. It will enhance food security by extending their purchasing power when they buy food at a farmer's market. It promotes healthy eating by providing an incentive to buy food at a farmer's market where they have greater access to fresh and locally produced food, and it supports local farmers who produce and market food at the farmer's market. The concept for this proposal, as Jessica explained, is based on a demonstration project called Market Bucks, funded by Blue Cross Blue Shield, very successful program. And it's an example of the kind of practical and results-oriented common-sense programs that can have an impact on reducing hunger in our state. Minnesota is very pleased to join Hunger Solutions of Minnesota, the Partnership to End Hunger, and the Healthy Kids Coalition in support of HF 352. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
And Madam Chair, just one other point that I wanted to raise. I do have a delete everything amendment. And on there, I just want to recognize we've been working with the Grocers Association to try and get them incorporated into this as well. So it's not just limited to the farmers markets. So
thank you. And let's go ahead and take care of that. I move that House File 352 be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. And we can go ahead and take care of your delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it. And so I move that amendment labeled DE1 be adopted. And members, are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. And so are there any other testifiers or people from the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Any further discussion from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I'm just trying to figure out how that works with existing pilots that, as far as I know, were not established through the Blue Cross Blue Shield, but are using EBT right now. I know that that's happening in my community, and I think it was actually established through the statewide health improvement program, but they don't, I think, have this $10 limit, and so I'm just wondering whether or not putting a $10 limit in statute would be a challenge, particularly when you have some ethnic groups that have large families and, you know, at the current cost at my local farmer market, the $10 wouldn't go so far. So I'm just trying to make sure that there's not a gap here, and maybe I have to do more research.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Loeffler. This is an issue that we've been working out with the Senate, too, as well. They were concerned that it was unlimited, and so we put the $10 limit in place. However, we're happy to work with you if you've got a better idea on how what the amount should be. I think that would be helpful to get your input on that as well. And I think we also have phone a friend here to help me out, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, so Market Bucks is actually $5. So as we take this pilot statewide, it would be $10. So it would be an increase from the pilot. And this would be a complement to actually some of the other projects that are running with WIC and seniors and others, as I understand it. So the $10 would be in addition, it'd be a bonus to what you spend with SNAP.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. Ms. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'll just verify with my local farmer's market that it all dovetails the way we'd like and see if they have some advice on the amounts. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 352, as amended, be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Say no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Our next file is House File 581, Representative Wills, and we'll be modifying the Homeless Youth Act. Welcome, Representative Wills. I think I'll go ahead and move the bill. It's House File 268, be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. And we're going to ask that everyone ask questions. Oh, excuse me, House File. No. You're right, 581. Thank you for that clarification. And also, we're going to keep all comments like we did on the first bill to the end, and then obviously we're trying to limit testimony as well to more than 3 minutes. So I guess that that's everything else. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm honored to be authoring House File 581, which makes two changes to the Homeless Youth Act, but understanding this is the policy committee, I'm focusing on the age change provision in the bill. And just a little bit of background, Homeless Youth Act serves Minnesota youth statewide and connects them with supportive adults and services that will aid in the transition to successful adulthood in a critical time in development when they need the support of caring adults most. So this has been in place for several years already, and what we're looking to adjust is the age limit, because currently the state limit for these services is up to age 21, and the federal limit is up through age 24, and we're looking to have federal conformity to make it much more efficient and streamlined to be able to provide these services and get the paperwork through, because currently these youth are still getting the services. It's just an excessive burden on the system to have to keep track of all of the different funding programs and paperwork needed to make sure that we're following the law correctly and getting these services to those who need it most. And just a little bit of background, we have about 13,000 public school students identified in Minnesota as homeless at some point between 2013 and 2014. So this is a very serious problem in our state, and the services that are provided through the Homeless Youth Act, the funding goes out through several different organizations and focuses on trying to get them connected with a caring adult, and whether they can go back home to be with their family or not. It's the first question that they address. And some of it goes towards transitional housing or emergency shelters. So those are some of the services that are available. And I have Patrice here with me today, who's going to explain a little bit more about the program, because she works with it every day.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patrice O'Leary. I'm Senior Director of Youth Services for Lutheran Social Service. We provide homeless youth services in the Twin Cities and in the surrounding regions of Duluth, Brainerd, Wilmer, Mankato, and Rochester. I join you today from my home community of Brainerd. Youth are homeless in our rural communities every night. And some of the youth that LSS has been serving in the last year reported to us where they had been seeking shelter. For example, in Rochester, youth found shelter under the bridge near the Perkins, that's called Perkins North, in the homeless camp in Slattery Park, down by the river behind the recreation center. In Mankato, youth found shelter sleeping in their cars, typically at the Walmart parking lot or in a grocery store that's open 24 hours, under the bridge between Mankato and North Mankato, sleeping in the hallway of an apartment building until concerned citizens contacted the police. They stay on the move. They wander through the night because there's no place for them to sleep. When businesses do open then, in places such as the mall near downtown, the county library, the coffee houses, etc., they'll find a bench and sleep for a while during the day. In Wilmer, our youth found shelter sleeping on the steps leading to the library's basement, squatting in an empty apartment, sleeping in a vehicle parked on the side of the street near their mother's, which they did for 2 weeks. This used up most of their paycheck that they were earning just to cover the cost of the gas running in the vehicle all night, every night. One young woman we were serving returned to the hotel room where she had been staying with an abusive ex-boyfriend just because she had no other alternatives. Recently, one of our Wilmer youth staff was contacted by a local sign language interpreter who had been in contact with a student that she formerly interpreted for in a school setting. The student was extremely hard of hearing and had been kicked out of her mother's home. She's been staying with her brother, who is receiving rental assistance through the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. The brother had received a letter that the sister needed to leave within 3 days or he would be served with an eviction notice. The brother, with his wife and 3 children, was reluctant to kick her out because there was no one else to take her in, and she was so vulnerable due to her disability. Our programs helped her with an emergency shelter in a hotel room, which is a typical method that we use in rural areas because we lack shelter beds. And while they worked with her and her mother to form a new and safe, stable plan for her, the plan was formed, it was followed through, and the youth did return home temporarily while her mother and sister worked out together to purchase a bus ticket for her to go stay with the sister in another state where she's now providing daycare while the sister works. In Brainerd, our youth found shelter sleeping in their car, sleeping in a camper, sleeping in a fish house, again wandering around all night, camping under the Mississippi River Bridge, and finding a place to sleep in the Evergreen Cemetery. I'd like to tell you about a young man from Brainerd. Austin is a 19-year-old young man who grew up with a single-parent home. He has no contact with his father and experienced domestic abuse at home at the hands of his father and of some of the companions of his mother. He moved around a lot, something like 19 times in 2 years. Never felt like he was able to form relationships, friendships, or develop any support systems. Austin's mom had a steady stream of boyfriends over the years and was seemingly always looking for love in the wrong places. One night his mother told him to leave because she would be entertaining a guest and don't come back. He found himself walking alone along Highway 210 by Staples, Minnesota, where they had been living. He was picked up by an elderly couple and brought to Brainerd, where he slept on the couches of whatever fast friends he could find there. Soon after, he was working full-time, got a job at a factory in Merrifield. He was carpooling to work with a friend that he also stayed with. One day, this ride left without him, and when Austin called him, he was told that his belongings were at the curb. So there he was, knowing very few stable people, out in the middle of nowhere and feeling really hopeless. He called LSSU Services Hotline. Staff picked him up, met his basic needs, helped him get some food and personal care items, and provided him with a hotel voucher where he worked with his case manager to find an apartment. He stayed 8 days in a hotel before moving into an apartment. He's still employed in Merrifield, which is 10 miles north of here. LSS helped him get a bike, so at that time he was riding to work on his bike back and forth every day until he was able to get a job closer to town. Now he's been in the same apartment for about 9 months. He's gotten his driver's license. He has a vehicle now. He has insurance. And he's still maintaining full-time employment, paying 100% of his rent on his own. He's a successful young man who's now looking at starting college in the fall. And homeless youth, our youth couch hopped, stayed in abandoned buildings, slept in their car, camped in a tent near the woods in downtown Duluth, and again wandered around all night, going to Walmart, sleeping for an hour here and there wherever they can find a place. A couple of days ago, one of our street outreach workers gave a homemade quilt to a 19-year-old man who was going to be sleeping outside that night. He'd been staying with a friend but couldn't stay there any longer, and he had slept outside on other nights. He said he wrapped up in a blanket, crouched in a doorway where he was out of the wind and unseen. So what do these kids need? What these kids need is more than a roof. They need the opportunity to develop into adulthood. The developmental stage of emerging adulthood is widely recognized as occurring between the ages of 16 and 24. Homelessness interferes with their healthy development. Adolescents, in general, are negotiating new roles to become socially competent. Without appropriate adult guidance, high-risk behaviors are more likely to emerge from the negative impact.
Thank you, Ms. O'Leary. Can you just wrap up, or are you about done?
Yes, I will. Thank you. So, you know, one of the things that we want to underscore is the importance of recognizing that these unstable circumstances do not have a hard stop at age 18. They don't have a hard stop at age 21. And it's far more efficient for us to continue the stabilization plan on the continuum of care for these young people in order that they might reach those important milestones and continue on to a successful adulthood.
Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers on this particular bill? Members, do you have any questions for our testifiers or our author? Representative Plum?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's more of a comment for the members. When you look at the age change, you say, well, that college students and that. When I was in college for a while, I did live in my car. And frankly, in the late fall, it gets a little bit cold. And it didn't seem to be visible back then. But so I understand that people find themselves in situations, and I hope no one has a problem with the age change.
Thank you, Representative Plum. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments. First of all, I want to thank Representative Wills for bringing this great legislation forward. There's a couple of things that I think that we should keep in mind tonight, particularly on a night that's particularly as cold as we are, is that by Wilder's estimates, there will be about over 4,000 kids on the street tonight. That's a disturbing number. Many of them are there not because of their own choosing. Many of them are coming out of situations where there's a clearly dysfunctional family, have been through physical or physical abuse or sexual abuse. And many of the times when we see them come through, I work at a homeless youth shelter in North Minneapolis, and many of the times when we first see them, the first things that they always say is, oh, we had problems with the rules at home. And actually, when you start diving down to what's really going on, you find out what the real excuses are, because nobody wants to admit that the reason they're homeless tonight is because of a dysfunctional home or the fact that they were sexually abused or physically abused. And these are the stories that we see on a regular basis, and there's such a great need out there. So I thank you, Representative, for bringing it forward, and hope that we can get this through and we can find funding. And it really needs to be up to age 24. I find at age 21, the youth that we work with still have the same needs. Is when you're coming out of a dysfunctional home environment, some of the things that we take for granted, knowing to brush your teeth, what's a food, fruit, what's a vegetable, many of these youth don't know that. They know they came out of a dysfunctional home, and because of the instances that they're coming out of, some of these youth are pregnant, and they're trying to figure out, how do I raise a kid in a much more healthier environment than what I'm experiencing right now? And so it's really critical that we provide these services, wraparound services, so that they can learn what is a healthy environment to raise a child and to help break the cycle of poverty. And that's when we start making a difference. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. I don't see any other further questions, so I will renew the motion that House File 581 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Wills and Ms. O'Leary. Our next bill that we have on deck is House File 361, Representative Quam. It's establishing a demonstration project to provide employment opportunities for persons with disabilities. Hello, Representative Quam.
Hello, Madam Chair, and I wish to move House File 361 to the be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services for finance.
Great. And I understand you have some testifiers as well?
I've got some people present who would be available for some questions, but the testifiers, we did put some video clips together, and I thought that might go smoother and take less of the committee's time. Many of you have probably also attended, while we're getting the technology up and rolling. Everything's slow in the cold weather. But basically, we've all seen, been to events or seen people testify about some of the difficulties or where the government programs don't quite seem to mesh, or there's a transition that is a little bit harmful if you're going to move to independence. And the intent of this bill is basically
to
say...
My name is Naomi.
Sorry, guys.
Well, the testifier is ready, and I don't know if it will project on the screens. And my once again, my name is Dwayne Quam. I'm not Naomi.
We're good. Yep. We're
Forgetting progress.
Hello, my name is Naomi Young, and I grew up in a basic middle class family in St. Charles, Minnesota. Shortly after I graduated from high school, which is about 30 years ago, I was the victim of a drunk driving accident. Today I'm a proud survivor of the traumatic brain injury I suffered. The drunk driver ran a red light going about 73 miles an hour, T-boned my car, put his Bronco on top of my car and tried to drive over it because he thought I was a speed bump. From that time on, I have been living in a body that I don't know anymore. I still have the same hopes, dreams, and aspirations, but I can't do them. I live in housing where my rent is based on my income. My health insurance premium is also based on how much I earn each month. If my earnings increase, my expenses increase. I also have to be aware every month of how much I earn so I don't hit that cap limit that's going to take my disability benefits away from me. That means I cannot work more than 14 hours a week. I do consider myself extremely lucky that I did find a job that I absolutely love. I'm very confident in the duties I perform, and also get a blessing by the security I have because I have my own on-the-job support team. I was so proud of myself and the job I was completing earlier this fall when I was offered a raise. The good old reality smacked me in the face, and I had to look at the whole picture of just what would happen if I accepted that increase in pay. It didn't look good. Unfortunately, accepting a raise has many negative impacts on those of us who are disabled. We're asked to do the absolute best that we can at a job, but if we get a raise, we get punished. If I accepted that raise, I would no longer be able to work the mere 14 hours a week that I do. I cannot work a 40-hour week job, but if I ever work a 20-hour, they'll take my disability benefits away. So if I accepted the raise, I have to cut my 14 hours back to probably 12 hours a week. The awesome mental and emotional benefits I lose every day while I'm at work would not be there. If I accepted the raise, my monthly rent would increase at a greater amount than my income increased. My health care premiums would also increase at a greater amount than my income increased. The positive benefits I constantly receive from my job are far greater than what any raise in my income could ever offer me. So I begrudgingly explained to my supervisor why I had to not accept that increase. What is the point of a disabled person performing a job well done when efforts are not able to be recognized and rewarded? We are told to get out there in the workforce and be productive, but when we do a job well done, we get punished. The income limitations for persons receiving disability benefits negatively impact us. We actually end up being punished by the laws, rules, and regulations by doing a job well done. Why do we have to routinely be the recipients of living a life in poverty? We are people who have a lot of pride and feelings and capabilities. We don't need to have a healthy and productive lifestyle taken away from us just because we are disabled. Thank you for taking the time and meeting with us tonight.
With a shatter in my lower right leg, it came 3/4 away out of the skin and was almost amputated. I cracked up in 5 different spots and suffered a traumatic brain injury. It erased all my memory. Once I got my heartbeat back, they put me in an induced coma for 2.5 weeks. And they said I'll never wake up from the coma again, if I did, I'd be a vegetable, and I would not be able to learn anything. As I woke up, I screamed at the top of my lungs. I did not know who I was, what happened to me, or anything. I wanted to go to college. Nobody said I couldn't because of my traumatic brain injury. I said, no, I am going to college. And then I applied for a scholarship, won it, and I went to Southeast Technical School in Minnesota, and right now I'm a certified network administrator. But one of the things that I ran into that has been so hard for me, I've been unemployed for about 3 to 4 years, and there's no real resources out there for disabled people that need to make a living wage. There is resources out there like ORC, but they're not paying up to make a living wage. And I would like more resources out there for people like us, who are survivors, to be able to come and see that there's other people like us, and let us know that we are not alone, and we're not helpless, that there is actual support out there.
My name is Jared Robinson, and I live in Altona. In June of 2004, I was in a horrific car accident on I-85, near where I live. This car accident caused me something in TBI, which made up injury. I T-bone was on my car controller without any seatbelts. I currently do not work, and I do not qualify for any of my social security is too high for any standards. When I work, I do not receive SSDI or Medicare. In the past, working caused me to lose my SSDI when I earned too much, and I could not afford MMPD, so I stopped doing it, thus losing my MA for working too much. I attempted to move back to my assisted living home. I got my own home, and I think they should getting on your own after I spent 6 and a half months in the hospital.
So, long and short was, I have a lot of medical issues I'm still working on. And you guys can fix those. That's up to Mayo Clinic, God, whoever's going to help me get better are going to do that. And I am getting a little better. What I'm going to put in front of you guys is, I'm on Social Security Disability. I qualified for that the first time I signed up for it. I did. They interviewed me and I did, which was good. But that's a pittance of what I used to make. If my wife wasn't working at Mayo Clinic with a pretty good job, I'd be destitute. So we're taking her income for me to survive. And I tried to cut all my expenses and stuff to nothing. But even so, if there's any other things out there available for somebody with a traumatic brain injury, something to help them get by with, something to go along with the disability where it doesn't impact the Social Security disability, because taking from one hand, putting it in the other doesn't really good. I need a little more. If I didn't have my wife taking care of me right now, I'd be destitute. And for an old type A type person, that's kind of tough to put up with. But she's a good woman, and she's doing it.
Well,
that always works.
The media we used flipped into a next thing, but basically, I use this. There are many other examples, many different areas, many disabilities, of where a common theme is you work, and frankly, that makes a person. That's better than a lot of medicines. The feeling you get from that work and that work going towards independence. But you come along in this program, you make a dollar more and you lose that, or you have to pay the full ride. Or you come along another program, you have a $65 a month or $35 or $25. If you have three or four different support things happening, as you're coming along, it's discontinuous. There are many times where you're punished for working more, for doing a good job. You heard about a raise. The idea behind this bill is to say we want people to succeed. We don't want to discourage their work, their effort, their success. So we would ensure that if they are working and they earn more money and they cross a threshold, that, you know, and I'm not rid of the 50%, but I think there should be enough of where they keep the money, that incentive, and they can continue to work towards independence. And the flip side is that we would get, the taxpayers would get a portion of their money back to cover the costs. But in the long run, as you're working, contributing, and becoming independent, you're paying taxes, you're buying goods, you're part of the community. So everyone wins. And the policy portion of this bill is that we want to not discourage a person working and becoming independent. We want to encourage it. And so that's what this bill does. And it makes it more predictive so that you don't have to watch, well, I can work a half hour more this week, or I can work 10 hours and it'll make up for the extra charge here and there. They have enough to worry about. So let's make it simple and easy that if you go over a limit, you're going to make more money. In the bill, it currently says 50%. So you make an extra $100, 50 goes as a copay, and 50 goes to cover your expenses, which I do believe taxes get taken out of that too. I do have some people here if there are some questions, but I just wanted to give you a taste. It would be going to the Finance Committee, and I will be looking for, you know, clarification amendments, suggestions, tweaks to make this work, because it's the principle and the ideal that's important to me, and your help to make the bill better and workable would be good for everyone. So I stand for questions.
Or do you want to have your testifiers speak? Or okay. Otherwise, questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, Representative Quam, have you talked with the Department of Human Services about this, and do you have anybody here, maybe you don't have them here, but maybe there's somebody from the department that could comment on this, because it wasn't clear to me from your the video that you showed us what program people are on, and, you know, there are different programs and different people have different situations, and it is all really complicated. I think we all know that there are certain cliffs involved in our programs, and over the last couple of years, certainly, and even for a while before that, there have been attempts to smooth out a lot of the cliffs. Certainly, we've tried to do that in healthcare programs, you know, for a lot of the same reasons, but it's really hard to understand what's going on here without understanding what programs people are on, exactly what the cliffs are, so maybe DHS can help us understand that. But did you talk to them about this?
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. Yes, I did talk to them about this bill and you know, some of the other bills, the general topic area. On here on the second page is the commissioner shall consult with the Council on Disability, the commissioner of employment, you know, deed, and you're basically looking at not duplicating services, etc. I wanted to make it service agnostic. I didn't want, even though, because that it was an event where I grabbed the clips from, there were a lot of similarities. I want it to be available so that people on disability, no matter what it is, no matter what the program is, that there would be a path, a bridge, to allow them to move towards independence. And yes, there needs to be some clarifying, but I did gain language from the assistance of the DHS people that I visited with and the revisers. So it's starting out as a core, and I welcome help adding on, but I have talked to them. And I specifically have tried to avoid, and will continue to avoid, making it just this program, this project. We would have to get some federal waivers, but we've done that in the past for different programs. And, you know, let's try and do what we can to make it more reasonable and less complex. Because you're right, there are so many different programs. There's so many different ins and outs of 100%, 180% of poverty, you know, etc. This is an attempt to make it easier for the people with disabilities to understand that they don't have to count the hours. It's okay if they get a raise, they can go on with their lives, and they know that they won't hit a pit where they all of a sudden lose $100, $200 and not understand why. Or they get a letter and they've got backdated 3-4 months. You know, I don't like that. I want a person to go out and live their lives with the least amount of complications. So I'm not sure if there is a DHS person present at this time, but I have talked with several members of the department.
Representative Liebling, can you follow up?
Well, I think somebody's coming down, ma'am.
Oh, okay, great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the records, please.
Hey, I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. We've reviewed the bill. There are some concerns and some suggestions for clarification that we can provide, and we'd be happy to work with Representative Klum on that.
Okay. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. You know, Representative Klum, I appreciate that you have the urge to help people, that you want to do good things, and I think that's something that we all share. And you know, it's great this session to see that the GOP members want to do that and that they are willing to spend whatever money it takes to do it. And I just hope that your urge to do that continues. You know, in the last couple of years, we raised taxes, as you know, and we did that against a lot of complaints that we were growing government, especially the part of government that seems to grow is Health and Human Services, as you know. And I keep saying that, of course, we all know that we need to be careful that we spend money only for those who really need it. We don't want to have any waste, fraud, and abuse and so on. But I'm glad to see sort of a growing recognition on both sides that there are big needs out there and that we're not meeting them. And not only for people with disabilities, but for all kinds of people who need some kind of a hand up. And that we all really want to make sure that every Minnesotan gets opportunities and that everyone can live a full life and contribute fully to our economy. I think that's very important. But you know, I'm happy to have your recognition that it costs money to do that. It's not only about, you know, obviously we need to streamline systems, but a lot of the reason these various restrictions are in place is because of financial restrictions. Because I think, as you're seeing, and a lot of the members are seeing, that these things cost a lot of money, and I'm glad to work with you and work with others on the other side so that we can, you know, make sure, even though it may end up growing government, which we know it does. That's what, you know, a lot of government spending consists of, is helping folks that have challenges. And I'm glad to see that you're on board with that, and I'm glad to work with you to move something like this forward and make sure that people can participate fully. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And just to remind everyone that we're going to stick with the policy side of this bill. The Finance Committee will deal with the money side. And next is Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Klum, I share your values in terms of wanting to help people achieve their maximum, and I think we've got, you know, we're trying to implement a U.S. Supreme Court ruling where we've just done a plan as a state called the Olmstead Plan to ensure that everybody has that chance for maximum independence and integration into society. But like Representative Liebling, I'm still just kind of trying to figure out what is the problem and can we solve it or where are the gaps, because that your witnesses talked about Social Security disability income, which is a federal program that we as a state don't really have anything to do with. We have established medical assistance employed persons with disabilities, MAEPD, that allows people to accumulate significant assets, allows them to earn, you know, more money. We have other programs that have sliding fees, and so that as you earn more money, you know, you do contribute more, and I still buy into that, that as you move up, you contribute as you're able. But I'm just a little nervous about the language, because on line 1.22 you have, that exceeds the income limits for public assistance programs of And I'm thinking of, like, our welfare programs for people without children that get you $203. I don't think you're allowed to have any income. And I know your goal was not to go down to zero. But I'm just trying to figure out how practically this works when we have such broad language. You might have some unanticipated consequences in terms of that 50% being a much higher number than you could even imagine when you have kind of this broader number. And so I'm urging you to work really hard with the departments and others and to try and really let us know who's still following through and what's the maximum they could be liable for under this. And would just having a demonstration program give somebody a reason to say, well, we're testing this out and go slower on the Olmstead implementation, because I know that's not your goal. So it's more of a comment than a question, but I am having a struggling as well to try and figure out who we're picking up and how that would dovetail with these other programs. But I agree with the goal.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, I've read the text of your bill, particularly that which is on the first page, and I'm hoping that you can give me a little clarification. The title itself leads me to a quandary in terms of, are we offering employment opportunities to the folks that would be applicable to this program, or are we availing them to a larger portion of the income that they would earn through employment opportunities that they would find on their own?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I didn't pick the... I used to write columns for the Pulse Bulletin for a nominal fee, and I never got to pick the title. And so maybe I'm a little bit easier at, you know, I didn't pick the title. I tried to pick the intent. I know it's more of, I have a dream of what I'd like it to be. Members are bringing up those realities. They'll trim it down. But if we have a project that allows to facilitate people with disabilities to work and have a career and reach their dream, level out the bumps, and, you know, that's the intent. Now, SSDI is one area, but I think we know a lot of different areas where there are bumps that hit, and every individual is different, and that's why it's got the consulting thing, because they say there's 10 people in the pilot. They each might have a different combination of programs, and the intent is to have it take that concern and worry away, so all they have to worry about, it's like the gentleman said, I'd like to stay in my house and be independent instead of being in a group home. We don't really know what the savings on the flip side is by, you know, 10% of the people being able to live independently instead of being in a group home or having to live in a care facility. And so that's why it's meant to be a study. If you've got suggestions for the wording, I am very open to that. But I think if we don't take the step and the attempt, we will never know. And some people will never know their dream because we have a system that doesn't work to help them achieve that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, just a little further down on that same page on line 1.23 through 1.25, you describe a sliding fee scale, and then you also refer to co-payments equal to 50%. And I'm just wondering, from a perspective of a person who's aspiring to realize a greater take-home income, what was the theme for the co-payment? What does that pay for? Who tracks that? And what does that fee go for that would benefit the person in this pilot project?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. I believe you're somewhat familiar with the SSDI program, and that's a discrete thing of where you come along, you earn a dollar, a penny more, whatever it is that puts you over the, now you have a discrete bump, and that's considered, I think it's called a copay in some of the documentation, and that's what this is meant as, to cover a copay similar to that. And there are other programs of where you earn past, and now you have to, you can keep all your programs, but you have to pay all of the money out. So the copay is 100% of the cost. So that's where the I want them a copay of where they can predict. They know. I mean, if when my sons got their job, they knew how many hours they worked, and they knew how much they had earned. They were surprised on the first check by how much was taken out for things. But after that, they knew that it, and they calculated that out. Our system is so complex that people don't know, and they get penalized. I would like to have it as simple as if I know I'm going to go over, but I'm going to at least get half or 40 or 60%, whatever the legislature decides. So, yes, it's a copay like other programs, but it's continuous instead of being discrete, because those bumps make it tougher on people.
We have a question also from Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, not as much a question, but I think a comment to an earlier comments, a comment made earlier. I think there was a comment about, you know, it's a good thing that Republicans are interested in this now, and I think, as I've said many times before, in this committee and others, there's what Representative Quam is doing with this issue, and what others are doing, looking at MA spend down reform or other things. These are extremely heavy lifts, and it's not going to be easy. And we're operating divided government, and that's good and bad. And so I think a lot of us are going to have to come to the table to work at things like this. I think the only way to make such a difficult task as what Representative Quam is trying to do, or with MA spend down reform, the only way to make such a difficult task even more difficult is as we go out through this session, if we continuously inject politics into it, and we look backwards and say, well, you wanted to do that, or we wanted to do that. This is too important. There are too many people that are counting on us to play that game. And so what I would again request of the committee, while we're all trying to work together, is let's keep the eye on the ball, let's look downfield, and let's try to work at this together. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Any other questions or comments? I will just add that I have heard about this issue quite extensively, talking to folks, that they're frustrated because they feel like they're penalized if they want to work more, and they feel very trapped in the current system. And, you know, I'll entertain any other questions. Otherwise, I guess we'll move to vote on the bill. Any other questions or comments? All right, seeing none. Quam renews his motion for House File 361 to be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion carries. Thank you very much. The next House file we have is number 522, Representative Zerwas, modifying the Family Assets for Independence Program. And as soon as you get settled, you can please move your bill and begin your presentation, and we'll again save questions at the end for Representative Zerwas and the testifiers at the end.
Oh.
Senator Zerwas.
Madam Chair and members, first I'll move House File 522 to be passed and re-referred to HHS Finance.
Thank you very much. Did you want to say anything about your bill or move straight to your testifiers today?
I'll just do a brief intro. The FAME program, Madam Chair and members, the FAME program is a pretty unique program for matching up people up to 200% of the federal poverty guideline with kind of financial coaches and assistance to help people put money away to build some savings. The program is pretty unique in that it offers a 3-to-1 savings return, and it and that money, as it's accrued over 24 months, can then be used for three distinct purposes: down payment on housing, education, or money towards starting a new business. I got introduced into this program through the TRICAP, the Tri-County Action Program, which serves also among two other counties, Sherburne County, where I represent, where we had a success story out of Elk River, where someone was able to utilize this program for a down payment for a home. And so it's a unique program. I first got involved with TRICAP when I contacted them to ask if they could expand some of their tax preparation services down to the Elk River area from where they'd been kind of a hub up by St. Cloud, and they came down 2 years ago for their first year, and we were able to do hundreds and hundreds of tax preparations for low-income families, and then learn more about the programs offered through these community action programs. So I'll turn it over now to Pam Johnson. She can talk about our request, which is for $500,000 to expand the financial counseling or the financial coaching aspect of this program, which is so vital.
Hello, Representative. Thank you, Representative Ms. Johnson. How are you?
Good. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Pam Johnson, and I work with Minnesota's Statewide Community Action Partnership. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about Representative Zerwas's House File 522, which provides support to the Statewide Family Assets for Independence of Minnesota, or FAME, program. FAME has had a powerful and lasting impact on the lives of thousands of Minnesotans and has demonstrated a strong return on investment over the past 15 years. Over 3,600 Minnesota households have saved collectively $3.5 million of their own income, $40 per month at a time, in matched savings accounts to acquire a long-term financial asset, as described, a home, post-secondary education, or small business. We all know that long-term assets help families weather life's financial storms and move beyond paycheck-to-paycheck living. A statewide collaboration delivers FAME, comprised of Bremer Banks, City County Federal Credit Union, Emerge Community Development, Community Action Agencies, the Urban League, Neighborhood Development Alliance, and Leech Lake Tribal Government. FAME participants deposit $40 a month in their local bank and receive a 3-to-1 match from state and federal funding. It's a true public-private partnership, as these funds leverage local and private funding as well. Participants work with a trained FAME financial coach, and you'll hear from one here, to complete 12 hours of financial education and additional 10 hours of asset-specific training to address credit or debt issues and prepare for their asset purchase. Your package contains this research report. It's a return on investment study that reports that nearly 90% of surveyed FAME small businesses are still thriving after 2 years or more, compared to the national average, which is 44%, so more than double. Over 85% of our higher education seekers met their goal or were in process. There were no reported FAME homeowner foreclosures despite the recent crisis. And public assistance usage decreased dramatically, as nearly 60% of participants accessed no cash assistance at program exit, compared to 12% at entry. We believe these strong outcomes are due to the one-to-one financial coaching and support that FAME participants receive from their coaches. The assets alert them to risky consumer products and demonstrate wise financial habits for lifelong practice, which is passed on then to the next generation. We're here today to thank you for your investment in FAME Financial Asset Building over the past 15 years and to seek support for the key coaching aspect of FAME, as Representative Zerwas said. A current $250,000 annual appropriation supports the FAME bank accounts, but not the key coaching element that makes the program so successful. FAME program providers have had to halt services due to the lack of adequate coaching funding, and this has created gaps in service delivery, primarily in greater Minnesota, as shown on the map that's in your packets. The yellow spots are where there used to be FAME, and they've had to temporarily succeed. Current FAME providers also struggle to secure stable resources and face service reduction. This bill would provide a $250,000 annual boost to stabilize FAME coaching, enable former and new providers to join, and leverage private and non-state resources. Thank you for your time, and I'd now like to introduce Sarah Priest, an expert FAME coach who drove down from Duluth, and Corey Olson, a successful FAME graduate who drove down from Moorhead.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, and co-authors, my name is Sarah Priest, and I am the Director of Asset Development and Financial Services at Community Action Duluth. I've worked with the FAME program for over 10 years, 8 years at Community Action Duluth, and 2 years with AOA, Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency in Virginia, Minnesota. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today, not just about the importance of FAME match dollars, which help hundreds of people throughout the state secure the invaluable resources of homeownership, business, and college, assets that propel and secure our family's financial future, but the critical dollars that go into making the FAME program happen. FAME coaching is the essential piece of the program that until now hasn't been truly understood nor appreciated. FAME coaches receive intensive training in a curriculum entitled Four Cornerstones of Financial Literacy that includes instruction on budgeting to create savings, debt reduction, asset building, understanding and building a good credit, consumer protection, and financial institutions. In addition, our entire network participates in regular and ongoing training meetings that are provided under the guidance and supervision of West Central Minnesota Communities Action, who's the program's managing and fiscal agent. As providers, we share best practices, stay on top of current financial topics and tools, and support one another's efforts to provide high-quality coaching for our participants. As coaches, we deliver the 12 hours of financial education and the 10 hours of asset-specific training that's required for participants before they can spend their funds. And we provide the ongoing individual financial stability support, education, and coaching that is vital to improve and sustain families' financial security. It's the coaching that makes the difference. I'd like to share a short story with you of one of my all-time favorite famers, Tanya. Tanya first came to Community Action Duluth with the goal to purchase a car through our Jumpstart program. Tanya is an in-home hairstylist who provides grooming services for the homebound, and her old vehicle was falling apart, putting her livelihood at risk. In the process of securing her new vehicle, Tanya learned about the FAME program, enrolling 2 months later. Now, it's hard to picture Tanya when we first meet her, a 42-year-old single woman who was incredibly uncomfortable and unfamiliar with banks and had no self-confidence about the ability to manage money, save, succeed, and get ahead. Enter FAME coaching and financial education. Tanya credits Common Sense, who in Duluth we call our financial education program, as the light bulb and the catalyst to her belief that she could learn, that she could get a handle on her finances, she could save, she could improve her credit, and she could dare to dream that one day she would own her own home. I especially feel proud because I taught that class that she was in. Tanya got so motivated by the FAME program and the partnership with her FAME coach, Rachel, that she totally changed her behaviors and she started saving big time. Tanya opened a parallel savings account, proudly bringing in her quarterly bank statements to show us how she was doing. Rachel and Tanya cracked down and buckled down to improve her credit. When she started out, her initial credit scores were in the mid-500s. Well, 14 months after opening her FAME account and with lots of hard work, Tanya did reach her dream and she purchased her first home. But her journey wasn't over. Tanya then used FAME to enhance her hair business, purchasing needed supplies and products, and paying off the principal of that car loan. Tanya today has completely changed her outlook, her view about herself and her future. With credit scores now in the mid-700s, fantastic savings habits for emergencies and for fun, and new long-range retirement savings in place, Tanya was all too happy to report to us recently that her second dream, to own a Harley, came true, and she paid for it entirely with her savings. Tanya's an incredible story of empowerment and change, and she is not uncommon. Many famers share the same story. At Community Action Duluth, we are privileged to have the support of our local United Way funds and Duluth LISC Local Initiative Support Corporation, and in the past, the City of Duluth's Community Development Block Grant Funds to provide the support of FAME coaching. And without this support, FAME would not really be possible in Duluth, and we are one of the largest providers of accounts statewide. Many partner agencies, as Pam mentioned in the network, have had to stop providing FAME resources throughout the state. And FAME truly is one of the greatest anti-poverty programs in place in Minnesota, with countless proven results because of a lack of funding and coaching. Many of the tools and match savings is only effective if there's a support for people to capitalize on the match. As a former rural Minnesotan, I can emphatically say that the resource of FAME needs to be spread statewide, and without coaching dollars, it's unlikely to happen. So as quoted yesterday by my FAME coach, Karen, FAME, together with FAME coaching, is just smart legislation. I sincerely hope you consider supporting the House File 522 for FAME coaching. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Corey Olson. I am the founder of OSCRAP. It's the business I created through FAME. It was founded in 2011 with the help of Intercounty Community Council in Oakley, Minnesota. And today, in 2015, I am still in business and ready to graduate out of the FAME program. It's not the dreaming that is hard for someone with a passion for something to come up with. It's the execution, knowing where to start, getting funds, finding resources, or even just putting thoughts down on paper is oftentimes so overwhelming and time-consuming that people panic or get burnt out quickly. And unfortunately, the dream stays just that, a dream, and doesn't make it into reality. Well, FAME turned my dream into reality, and thanks in large part to my FAME coach. My coach was not only a resource for questions and ideas, or even just an advisor, she was an inspiration. She inspired me to dream big, create new products. She got me answers. She helped me brainstorm, helped me with purchases, and just lifted me up when I was feeling down about my business, just by reinforcing my talents and creativity. I actually started my FAME journey with the idea of education in mind. It was an awesome opportunity, but I had already finished 4 years at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and it just didn't seem like the right path to continue on. My coach offered understanding and helped me to restart from scratch with FAME, learning that the business path, was the best path for me, as I had a business degree and always, always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Through the financial literacy classes, which I was fortunate enough to take twice because I was eligible for the program 2 times, I learned a plethora of information. From that information, I was able to develop a strong business plan with the mission of bringing memories back to life. Through these classes and the coaching accompanying them, my credit, income, and financial stability went up over time. And I am happy to say that I will no longer be eligible for FAME because of this. And I think this is the pinnacle of the program's success. I have created products that my customers demand, can personalize, and also preserve their memories in. A priceless product, as one of my customers told me. My skills are in demand. I have taught art classes and have kept art alive in my community, which was one of my original goals starting out. I turned a hobby into a successful business, developed an ethically strong reputation for myself as an entrepreneur, as well as generated another source of income. And it hasn't always been easy, but it's been worth it, and I have my coach to thank for that. And I've always had her to go to. Bottom line, FAME helped and encouraged me to become a thoughtful and informed member of society, giving back to those who deserve it, need it, and appreciate the opportunities they are giving. Given as Inter-County Community Council and this wonderful FAME program did for me. In closing, the mission of FAME is to escape poverty and achieve wealth through asset acquisition, and I believe strongly that my testimony should be evidence of the success of this program, and that's why I'm hoping you will support this.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Ms. Priest for coming to testify and all the other testifiers. I think this is a great program, and I'm really proud of our community action in Duluth and everything they do. So thanks again, Sarah. And I just have one question. You mentioned the woman that had needed a car. I'm wondering, are there car loan programs like Jumpstart throughout the state, and could we use FAME money to invest in a car loan? Is that needed, or are there other programs to fill that gap?
We can certainly answer that, but we'd like to stick to the finance portion of this, but go ahead if you know the answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, there are other car programs, and interestingly enough, there is another bill working its way through to expand car programs in Minnesota as well, so another asset building program.
Thank you. Any other questions or testifiers for this bill? Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I'll just close by saying the important thing for this bill and the additional money is we're filling gaps where the program was previously very successful in greater Minnesota, and certainly there's an opportunity to backfill and replenish that service, and so I can't wait to talk about it in finance.
So, that being said, Representative Zerwas renews his motion for House File 522 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Yeah. So, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you. Our next bill is Representative Freiberg, House File 525, and it's our last bill, I'm happy to say. It is expanding, I'm sure he's around here somewhere, we can get ready. It's expanding the Integrated Healthcare Delivery Network Pilot Program.
I know.
There he is. Welcome, Representative Freiberg, to the committee, and I'm sure you'd like to move your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Peterson. Yes, I'd like to recommend to re-refer House File 525 to the HHS Finance Committee.
Very well. And I understand you have a delete all amendment labeled DE1 in your folders to get the bill in shape the way you'd like it. And if you'd please move your amendment.
Sure. I'd like to move my amendment. What it does basically is I understand there were some concerns Hennepin County had with adjusting the existing statute. This just to address those concerns places it in a new statute.
So Representative Freiberg renews his motion that DE1 amendment be adopted. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. And then we'll let you discuss your bill as amendment and any testifiers that you might have.
Sure. The bill relates to people with multiple complex health issues. It would allow North Memorial to continue and expand the work they've been doing over the last few years. And it would allow North Memorial to partner with a third-party administrator and to bid in the 2016 Medicaid procurement process. North Memorial began successfully managing contracting risk and care coordination with Medicaid populations when the legislature turned to North Memorial, HCMC, and Regents Hospital to implement the coordinated care delivery systems population when the legislature eliminated GAMC. And with me today is Dr. Kevin Croston, Chief Medical Officer with North Memorial Healthcare, who can add additional light on this proposal.
Please state your name for the records and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. J.P. Kevin Croston, MD, and Chief Medical Officer at North. North Memorial has been working in this arena since the CCDS program was out. We've had to develop care coordination, medical home. We've learned to manage the transitions of the patients better, than we've ever had to do before. We were one of the three recipients that shared in the shared savings from your IHP program recently. We take care of these folks currently for you. We think we can save you money. We'd like to be able to directly contract with the state to provide services for those patients. A large variety of them come to us. We think we can, with the coordinated care experience that we've had, we would have a lot to offer you folks.
Thank you. Representative Feibert?
Happy to stand for questions.
All right. Any questions, members? Representative Blossler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just trying to still understand how all these pieces might fit together. Maybe we can talk further when it's in the finance division, because I haven't had a chance to really understand your model, because we have authorized a variety of different models here to experiment with ways to reduce healthcare costs. Some of which health plans are competitive on, and some of which we authorize separately in statute for the counties that operate the major MA safety net hospitals with significant property tax contribution, which is Hennepin County Medical Center and Regions. And the Hennepin Health Model, which in the previous term we heard testimony on, and they've gotten quite a bit of national attention, is really a unique model that has really integrated the human services side of the county along with the healthcare side, and so that there's actually savings to the entire system of MA, not just to the healthcare side. And my concern, if we were to authorize another competitor within Hennepin County, would be to make sure that that intersection doesn't in any way threaten the success of a program that's really targeted at the most difficult, most expensive chronic alcoholics, other, you know, high users of expensive both health and social services, and that we don't allow a new competitor to, quote, cherry pick sort of some of the easier ones to stabilize and have some health care savings and jeopardize the viability, because I know that the county has assumed the risk on that particular contract, so it actually is a taxpayer risk. And so these are very complicated, confusing programs, and I just wanted to let you know that, you know, I'll be working with Representative Freiberg and North Memorial and Hennepin before it goes to the Finance Committee, just to make sure we have a lot of programs. They don't always sometimes dovetail as nice as we'd like, and we need to just make sure that what we've got works.
Would like Representative Feibert?
Sure. I'd certainly be happy to work with, thank you, Madam Chair, I'd certainly be happy to work with you, Representative Loeffler, to address any of those concerns. My understanding is some of these concerns have been worked out with Hennepin County. I know there's a representative from Hennepin County here. Dr. Crosston, looks like he's...
Yeah, I was going to say, thank you, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative. We have vetted that with Hennepin County, and it's at least my understanding that they're in favor of us moving this along. The patients that you're talking about, all of us have. Hennepin County has shared a burden in the county, and I don't really think it's a competitive issue here. I think what it is, we're trying to service that patient population in a way that incents the right behavior, which would be allowing us to try to manage them more successfully out of the hospital setting and in the ambulatory setting where care is cheaper, and it allows us to coordinate that. So the risk contracts are exactly what we're talking about. That does incent the right behavior from the health systems, and we'd like to participate in that.
Representative Loeffler?
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just follow through, and we'll all learn more as we go along. I mean, I think it's great that we have so many people who are trying to figure out how to better manage people's health care in the most cost-effective way possible.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right, Loeffler over there, and I'm Liebling, and you're not the first to get a confused, not at all.
Well, I knew you were next up. So.
Yes, yes, thank you, if we have the misfortune of having names next to each other, too. So thank you for this. Thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Freiberg. I want to understand just a little bit more of why we need the bill and what exactly the bill does. And I went to North Memorial with Representative Freiberg some months ago and was very impressed, and kind of view this as a little bit of a continuation of the conversation that we had and around what North Memorial is able to do and wants to do. And I'm just trying to understand, though, why you need the special authorization. Is this still something that can't... Okay, let me put it a different way.
tell me if I'm wrong about what I think this is doing. Are you pulling people out of the PMAP system and assigning them to a North Memorial model? And are you picking people, you're picking people to do that with who have these complex or multiple medical problems? Is that kind of what this is about, or what would this look like from the patient side? What patient would you be picking, and how would
right.
the patient experience it?
It's a good question.
Dr. Cross.
We haven't made it very clear. Let me see if I can try. We don't get to pick the patients. This bill simply allows us to directly contract with the state for our pool of patients. What we learned from both all those other programs that were successful was that if you risk stratify the patients into groups, the top 10% or so are the ones that spend 90% of the spend. And so you can effectively reduce the spend on those folks if you can manage them in a cheaper care setting, and it involves applying a resource to them that currently isn't compensated under the current payment models to keep them out of the hospital. And so it isn't about, I've heard this a few times, are we sub-selecting patients out? It's getting a pool of patients that the state assigns to us and then managing them and figuring out who they are, applying our population health software to them, understanding what things we might be able to figure out to do to keep them out of the hospital and managing successfully in their homes and in the ambulatory sides of things. And that's basically the premise of all of it. And that's, we've done that three different occasions, and it's saved considerably in all three situations.
Representative Liebling? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't mean to say that you're going to try to cherry-pick anybody. I mean kind of the opposite. I'm just kind of wondering, if it's the state who selects them, how is the state going to select them under this? I mean, I'm assuming that what you're talking about is patients who are hard to deal with, not that you're trying to cherry-pick the easy ones, but that you're trying to take the ones who need a lot of management to put them in a, to try to cut the cost. I understand what you're talking about there. I'm just wondering how this group is going to get selected, and then what does it look like from the patient side? Is the person going to be told, you're going to North Memorial for your care, and you can only go to North Memorial, or how does that look?
Dr. Costin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I know the specifics of how the state assigns the patients to us, and I don't know if others here do. Buck, do you want to comment on that?
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Buck McCalpin, representing North Memorial. Representative Liebling, great question. This doesn't change anything with the competitive bid process. So whether you're a health plan or you're MHP with Hennepin County or you're North Memorial working with a third-party administrator, by June of this year, we would have to have a RFP prepared that, or a proposal we submit to the state to identify we'd like to take care of 30,000 Medicaid patients, 5,000, and that decision is made by the commissioner and DHS over how they would assign them. There's things about zip codes where assignments are made based off population location. And I think still, I think I have this right, the most important piece of it is the patient gets to pick that provider too. On the managed care side is their first choice, and then if they do not pick a provider, there is a default system the state has that kind of changes during their procurement process over where they are. So we could still go through this process, invest the time and money to put it together, and then not be chosen as a site to offer this in 2016. We haven't heard that we may do this. We may not be ready by June to do this, but our goal is with statute is just to be clear that we have the authority to do this. And not only in Hennepin County, but some of the edge fringe counties around Hennepin that use North Memorial for their day-to-day health care.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So this doesn't require the commissioner to enter into this. It just authorizes it. I guess I'd have to reread it after what you just said, but that's kind of what I'm understanding. You're nodding your head. Okay. Okay, and thank you for that. And this thing about how people pick, you know, right now in PMAP when they sign up for MA and they, you know, they have to choose a plan, and then certain number of them don't choose anything because a lot of people, you know, choosing is a tough thing. And, you know, in this population, for a lot of folks, it's especially tough. And so they fall into this default group. And I know exactly because I once carried a bill to try to set up a county-based purchasing program in my county. And what it, the only thing it did was take those patients that you're talking about who don't choose, and weren't able to do it. But I
see where you're trying to go here, and I appreciate it. I think it's a good thing for the state to try to work on these different models and try to find different ways to manage these folks who do cause a lot of the expense in the system, and probably equally importantly, their care can be better if they're managed in a better way. So we've seen that in other places, Hennepin being one, and great idea, and good luck.
Thank you. Representative Zerwa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a better question for Mr. McAlpin. I've got some questions about this bill, and as it's been pointing through, and some folks have expressed some concern. So I'm just wondering, you mentioned the RFP and something in statute. Is North Memorial Planning preparing a response for the RFP? And if, you know, on the county-based approach, and if we pass this, does this exempt you all from the RFP process? I guess one of the concerns is that it might be an end run around the statewide RFP for the county, Karen. Just kind of wondering, just got to get it out in the open and make sure we're all snugly on the same page.
Mr. McAlpin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Zerwas. I actually had that conversation with the state Medicaid director the other day, that this does not preclude us from the competitive process.
Okay. Representative Zerwas?
And then just one other question about the Hennepin Health. You know, one of the, and I think kind of dovetailing off of Representative Loeffler's comments, a big component of it, especially in the cost savings, is the kind of the comprehensive nature of the program. And so I'm wondering if that's kind of your vision for this as well, as far as the social services aspect of it, because I think to realize those the larger scale cost services, it's going to be a comprehensive care model. I'm just wondering if you can kind of go into some details on that, whether it's to the author or to one of the testifiers.
Who wants to take it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, we currently are caring for these folks, and you're absolutely spot on that half of their problems are their socioeconomic status and what happens to them once they're diagnosed with a medical concern, or where do they live, all the other things that are associated with that. We're dealing with them currently. We work through the county when we can. We work through private groups when we can. We lease detox beds in private facilities at our expense in order to manage the patients more efficiently. And that's exactly what this kind of a bill, this kind of a authorization helps us do. We don't get paid for doing that right now. So we lease the beds because it costs us less than to do it in our hospital. Down the road, this incents us to put the patients in the best place we can to get them the right kind of care in the cheapest, most efficient fashion. And I think it has worked at Hennepin for exactly the reason that it would work for us.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the comments that are made by all three of you refer me to, you know, in terms of an assessment of effectiveness. And to that point, my first question, and this would be for the doctor or maybe even for the author of the bill, I'm reading this language, and I don't see anywhere in here where there is documentation in terms of how will we assess effectiveness for the program.
Dr. Costin?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. the way it's been done historically is they've been able to show savings based off of what they've spent the year before with a comparable patient group. We would be under those same guidelines. This has been tried already by Hennepin County, and there's been savings achieved through a similar kind of a program. So I have no doubt that the savings will be there. And if we need to, in an RFP process, I think part of what the commissioner will look at is what we think we're going to help save them as a part of that process. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
I'm sure.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe to follow on and maybe jump through the ditch and into the corn, you talk about in the body of the language about evidence-based effectiveness, and I'm just trying to figure out. You also say that you're going to equal the cost of care that would otherwise be spent for these enrollees in the prepaid medical assistance program. So how do those marry up in terms of getting paid the same and documenting the effectiveness? How are you marrying those two together? Maybe it's because we've already done it at Hennepin Health. I'm just trying to understand how it's going to work for you.
Dr. Costin?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So currently, the way that we're paid on a per-event basis. arguably at a discount, but we're paying a per event basis. So the same thing is true going forward. We're going to get a dollar amount that we manage a number of patients in a population under, and if we can do that more efficiently and create better outcomes for it, the state should see the savings through that model, because we won't be spending the money the way we were spending it under the fee-for-service model.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author of the bill, is there any language that would be appropriate to say that this pilot project will be reported back to the legislature or to the commissioner?
We'd be happy to do that. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We'd be happy to do that. I would think it's going to be, all of these programs are scrutinized on an annual basis and evaluated as to their effectiveness, and that's been our expectation that we would need to do that as well with this.
Thank you. Our next, we have two more people who have questions. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, I'm going to want to work with you a lot on this, too. I'm concerned about the same thing that Representative Loeffler, although I'm not sure, are you just talking about HCMC, or also, I know North Point is an issue. It's run by the county, but I don't think it's part of HCMC. But I know that at a lot of our community meetings on the north side, especially among the African American community, there's a lot of concern that North Memorial is coming in and cherry picking, hurting our other clinics and things like that, and there's a very strong feeling in that community. So I want to be sure that this is not going to be a problem on those type of issues. So I hope that the health department will also, if there's anybody here, get with me as to what they know about this, and Representative Freiberg, we need to work, because as you know, it's North Memorial's one block from the north side, so get a whole lot of people. And I've been at a number of community meetings in the last few years where people have gone very irate when there's talk of North Memorial moving in. So we need to work on this. I understand the concept, and I like that, but we've got to work with how it's affecting other providers and things like that.
Representative Freiberg?
Sure, Representative Mullery, thank you. As with Representative Loeffler, I'm happy to work with you on that. I feel somewhat more comfortable with this, knowing that Hennepin County isn't opposed to this, but certainly if any concerns do arise, I'm happy to work with you to address them.
And
Representative Mullery?
And it's not just Hennepin County, it's the other providers out there. Okay, thank you.
Dr. Costin?
Yeah, maybe I can respond to that. Thank you, Madam Chair. We work pretty closely with the FQHCs that are in our neighborhoods, which are the clinics you're talking about. And we've had conversations with them. We've actually tried to deal with the north side, because a large pool of the patients that we're talking about right now come from that side, and they come to us for their care when they need their inpatient care. So we talked earlier about putting clinics into some of those service areas, again, to try to divert the patients to a cheaper care model, because what they do right now is show up to the emergency room. And what we've done instead, because we heard that feedback that they felt that that was competitive, so we backed off on that. And what we do right now is we have a collaborative relationship with North Point, with Johnson Street Clinic, and there's one other one that I'm blanking on. But and we send the patients there from our emergency room. We've got people in our ear that are diverting them to those facilities if they seem like the appropriate kind of care that's being provided. I think they'll benefit from this process, not be harmed by it.
Representative Mullery?
I think you'll work together on it.
We'd have to.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to understand what we as a policy committee are saying when we pass on this bill, in terms of where we're currently in an RFP process that DHS has issued the RFP already. It's been published. And so by passing this law, do we expand who's eligible to respond? Is it because you're not organized as a risk-bearing entity that you need the law? I'm just trying to figure out why you need the law in order to respond to the RFP, or is it to get access to a particular group of patients? I'm just still trying to understand sort of what is the basis for needing to have a special statute for
a hospital network.
Who wants to take that? Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. Great question. Who would like to think we could do it right now without a statute? But I think there's some grayness in the area of what's been passed in the past from the integrated health care, the old HCDS models, or what is what we consider more along direct contracting. And as Dr. Crossan alluded to, some of the current payment models and how we work under, following in the direction of the Hennepin and Ramsey County pilots along this line, we discussed around our table in North Memorial's Finance Committee that it was probably a better option to move forward with listing it in statute to be sure that we were eligible to apply in the competitive bid process.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I still have concerns because I feel like what I'm hearing you describe is really what we have done with the other innovative projects of DHS for accountable care organization contracting, which I think, you know, is fine. It's focused primarily on the acute care, but we're identifying it as a pilot. So it seems like it's being pulled out of something, and I'm still just not clear. And we're just going to have to work on understanding, you know, what is that that gives it that special pilot designation. And I understand it on the Hennepin Health model because it's actually run by the county. HCMC is a vendor, just like North Point, just like any mental health clinic in the acute care side, but they also work on getting jobs for people and housing and things that are not typically health care. So I'm just trying to understand better, and because it is a policy choice that we're letting someone else into the market and telling DHS they should consider them on some different basis, and I'm just still wrestling with that. And it wouldn't matter if it was a regional, you know, a Ramsey pilot or a St. Louis County pilot. I just really like to understand who were advanced, how it fits in the system.
And I presume Representative Freiberg will work closely with Representative Loeffler and Representative Mullery to make sure that we craft something that will really help the people of Minnesota and we can get some more innovation within our healthcare system models that we currently have. So any other further discussion for today? Otherwise, Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 525 as amended be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. And members, our next meeting will be Tuesday, February 24th at 2:45 p.m. And this meeting is adjourned.